7:30 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Beth Voorhees. In Pittsburgh, Mike Gordon credits his father for beginning the tradition of an ice rink in the backyard.
I really do believe it was something he gave to us that was a gift that I want to pass on to my kids, and I hope that it kind of continues through the generations. I know that sounds a little sentimental or whatever, but it's true. It really is.
The story coming up on this West Virginia morning. Panelists discussing the media coverage of the recent Elk River water crisis say digital media platforms played an important role in how they covered the story. As Beneduccio reports, more than 100 people were in attendance last night at West Virginia University to hear insights from panelists gleaned from reporting the event.
The panel discussed local and national news media coverage of the chemical spill that left 300,000 West Virginians without water. It not only brought together working journalists and broadcast and print media, but also a blogger and a documentary photographer who covered the story for the Guardian newspaper. Many panelists admitted learning about the crisis by following Twitter feeds. April Call with the television station WOWK in Charleston says the situation was a game changer in her newsroom.
We were exchanging a lot of information with our contacts, the governor's office, health departments, other water companies. And so it really did start an online conversation through social media, probably Twitter in terms of sourcing, but for us, Facebook became a real way to disseminate information to viewers, because no matter where they were, what time of the day it was, they could get that information. And we started to really see tremendous interaction between our viewers on Facebook and information, photos, tips, and then that would give us the nugget of information that we could then use to take to our contacts at various agencies.
Another panelist, Roger May, is a documentary photographer originally from Mingo County. He covered the story for the publication The Guardian. May used Instagram to emphasize the connection between two aspects of the story.
I made a picture of the Capitol, and then I thought, well, Freedom Ministries, let me see the proximity of Freedom Ministries from here. And so I, you know, mapped it out, and 3 miles away from the Capitol. And for me, that was a lead into using those two locations as a visual thread to connect a story to tell people on the other side of the world, this isn't just some holler in southern West Virginia or anywhere else. This is 3 miles from the state capitol.
And while Twitter and Facebook were also used to gather information, a lot of the information gathering came from good old-fashioned boots-on-the-ground journalism practices. This includes knocking on doors to get that info. David Gutman with the Charleston Gazette recounts his experience.
It was a challenge sometimes getting people to respond to you. I think in that first opening day and a half or so, what I was most frustrated about was that Freedom Industries was this company that spilled the chemical, and they were totally silent. I remember that Thursday night, I was just so mad. I couldn't sleep, and I woke up at like 5 o'clock, and I had all the previous evening, I'd been calling the president of Freedom Industries' home number, and no answer. And I drove out to his house and sat in the car. I'm like, you can't knock on somebody's door at 5 o'clock. What are you doing? So I sat in the car and listened to ESPN radio for like an hour and a half until it was 7 o'clock. I'm like, okay, now I guess now you can. He wasn't there, so that was all for naught. But I was still mad, and so then I drove down to Freedom Industries and knocked on the front door, and there was a secretary there, and I said, hey, is there anyone to talk? And she said no, and I just kind of started wandering around the facility, and I took some pictures and tweeted them.
While the journalists agreed there were benefits to using social media, there were also challenges. Dave Boucher works for the Charleston Daily Mail.
There's always a temptation, at least for me, and I think other people too. You have this information, it seems like a good nugget that you should get it out there as soon as possible. But, and even, you know, from the state, I know we've received conflicting information numerous times from the state. And you put out, for example, that the site hadn't been inspected since 1991. And that was picked up by everybody, and everybody reported it a ton of times. And then we find out a week later that there have been all sorts of inspectors at the site for 20 years, and it was just the DEP. It took a little longer to find the information. And while, you know, obviously you can't control the information you receive, I think social media allows us to get that information out much faster and on a wider scale. And regardless of whether or not you did something wrong or somebody else did something wrong, it can make for errors, you know, going out on a to many more people.
One of the most interesting points raised during the conversation came from Eric Wagner, who is a professor at West Virginia Wesleyan College. He blogged during the event, and one of his posts, an impassioned rant entitled "To Hell With You," made waves in the blogosphere. Wagner joked to the audience that he's not a journalist. In fact, he says he made most of his posts while wearing a bathrobe on his couch, but he still made a lot of noise and got noticed.
And I got emails, I mean, literally from all over the world. Within the first few days, I got emails from Denmark, India, Ireland. I found out the guy who draws Homer Simpson on The Simpsons linked to it on his Facebook page. And at that point, I was like, I win the internet. I'm done. That's it. That's all, you know. But like people, and I got emails from chemical engineers and from folks, the director of the public policy program at Harvard. I mean, it's weird. Like people who had absolutely no reason to get in touch with me other than this piece.
One of West Virginia Public Broadcasting's own reporters, Ashton Mara, was on the panel. When asked what lessons she learned from her experience, she points to the source, literally.
I guess what I took away from all of this is how important it is to know your sources. And I have always found, I haven't been doing this for long, but I have found that you need to know your sources in good times when there is nothing for them to tell you in order for them to tell you the things they need to tell you when things are bad.
The panel event was part of an ongoing series at WVU, The Future of Media Now, which looks at how national news stories are being covered. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Beneduccio in Morgantown.
About 800 people are expected to attend a conference at Marshall University in Huntington next weekend for the 37th annual Appalachian Studies Conference. As Cecilia Mason reports, for 2.5 days, those attending will explore everything from economic to environmental to cultural issues.
Marshall University education professor and conference organizer Linda Spadick says the theme is known realities and imagined possibilities.
I guess the imagined possibilities, one of the things I hope comes from that part of the theme is giving a good bit of attention to Appalachian activism. What can we do to make a better future in Appalachia, not just in our scholarship, but in our community, in our roles in our communities?
Spadick says the Appalachian Studies Association, which hosts the conference, also wants more young people involved.
Sometimes we at our conference have lamented the fact that the folks on our steering committee or the folks in the audiences were getting gray. We're seeing fewer young people come in, and that trend is beginning to shift, and we wanted that to continue to shift with a focus on contemporary issues. So we're not just valuing and respecting the long traditions of music and quilting and the foods and all that, but we're also paying attention to the diversity and good things and problems that exist in Appalachia today.
Interest in defining the region dates back to the late 1800s with Berea College President William G. Frost. Appalachian Studies Association President and Berea College Professor Chris Green says interest increased in the 1960s during President Johnson's War on Poverty.
Then in the 1970s, when there was also the rise of ethnic and racial awareness, whether or not it's with La Raza and the Chicano community, whether or not it's with African Americans and Black Power, there is also a sense of Appalachians being come together too. When I say Appalachians, I don't mean the white people in Appalachia. I mean all peoples in Appalachia, because Appalachia, like the rest of our nation, is in a conglomeration of many different races and many different ethnicities, because we share this thing in common, and this thing is a place where everybody lives.
But Green says perceptions of Appalachia based on images created during the War on Poverty still remain. He cites a story by ABC News anchor Diane Sawyer called A Hidden America, Children of the Mountains, as an example.
And we saw that with the Diane Sawyer 2020 episode about Martin County, Kentucky, that she was focusing on there. I just had students down from Vermont who asked me, they had come down to work with the Christian Appalachian Project, whose 50th year anniversary it is, too. Is Mountain Dew Mouth real? Which was something that happened on that 2020 show. And I talked to them about the lack of health care, the need for better insurance, the need for jobs, for people to have good food access as well. And so those images are still out there, unfortunately. The fortunate part is that people all over Appalachia, people have been doing hard, important work of affirmation and reclamation to, and going beyond those images into the cultural wealth of people all over the place.
Green points out the war on poverty has helped with building a foundation of infrastructure across the region that includes highways as well as water and sewer systems. He says the challenge now is building up the human capital.
I think a really good example of where we see a lot of that going on is with Create West Virginia, drawing together a group of disparate entrepreneurs from all over the state to get together and to think about the resources that are there that they can make amazing good things happen with and profitable businesses happen with as well.
The conference will offer sessions and research presentations. Topics range from exploring the coal industry, mountaintop removal mining, and environmental concerns, to looking at healthcare needs and access, as well as literature, food, music, and gender issues. Green says one particularly timely presentation on Friday morning will explore the economic, cultural, and social conditions in the Carpathian Mountain region of Ukraine.
There's a saying that Jerry Williamson, who's the old editor of the Appalachian Journal, had, and he says, everybody's got one. And the one that everybody has is a place of raw resource extraction in the mountains. And that's true whether or not you're in Italy or whether or not you're in the Ukraine in the Carpathian Mountains, that all industry needs the minerals. They need the timber. And as a result, these mountain areas are underdeveloped, oftentimes economically, and culturally quite different from the surrounding areas. So the Ukrainians who are coming, this has been going on, maybe 10 years or longer, where we've had very rich cultural exchanges with the Ukrainian Carpathian Mountains and Appalachia. But there's that kind of long-term resonance and connection, whether or not it's with the mountains and the coal in Colombia and the issues that those coal miners are facing, or the coal miners here in Appalachia are facing. We have a lot to learn from each other, both in our own communities and from around the world.
Conference organizer Linda Spadick says pre-registration is not required and walk-ins are welcome. She says thanks to a West Virginia Humanities grant, some of the events are also free and open to the public, including three plenary sessions and the keynote address by Kentucky writer Silas House. The conference starts Friday morning and ends Sunday afternoon. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Cecilia Mason.
This is West Virginia Morning at 7:43. And snow likely today. Temperatures will be in the 20s and 30s. A winter weather advisory in the eastern mountains. Snow accumulations of 6 inches possible there. Snow continues overnight with lows in the teens and 20s. Becoming partly sunny on Wednesday. Temperatures in the 20s and 30s by Thursday. Partly sunny skies and warmer with highs reaching the 50s and 60s.
Support for West Virginia Public Radio is provided by the West Virginia Division of Rehabilitation Services, enabling and empowering workers with disabilities to meet business workforce needs. Visit wvdrs.org for employer services.
Backyard and neighborhood ice rinks have long been a part of winters in Canada and the northern U.S. But with a warming climate, that could be changing. A group of Canadian scientists are asking backyard ice rink owners in North America to engage in a little citizen science by answering the question, were you able to skate today? The Allegheny Front's Carol Holsoppel has the story.
After school one day in February, Mike Gordon escorts his daughters, Rebecca and Dora, onto an ice rink that's a little unusual. It's in the front yard of their Pittsburgh home.
I think the middle is going to be better, guys, because there's some snow on the outside around the edges.
One reason the Gordons bought this house was because it had a nice flat front yard, perfect for a DIY ice rink. When I visited, 8-year-old Dora in pink earmuffs said she likes that she could come out and skate whenever she wants.
How long can you stay out here before you have to go back inside?
I don't know, until I'm freezing.
The surface of the 20 by 40 feet rink is kind of crunchy and uneven today, since it's been sleeting. Gordon levels some rough patches for the girls by scraping it with a hockey stick.
The best conditions are when it's really, really cold and really clear and not a lot of precipitation, because then it just freezes and it has that sort of glass, you know, glass smoothness to it, and that's when you have really the best skating.
The wood frame goes up around Thanksgiving, and when the weather gets cold enough, Gordon fills the plastic-lined rectangle with water from a garden hose. The family and their neighbors skate and play hockey here mid-December into February or March.
The way I figure it around here is if we get 10 skates in during a winter, I'm very happy.
Last year, they only got 2 or 3 skates in. The year before that, none at all. That's exactly the kind of information that a team of Ontario-based scientists is looking for. Last winter, they launched RinkWatch, an online crowdsourced map of ice skating rinks all over North America.
We were hoping that maybe by the end of the winter we might have 50 or 100 rinks participating. We had that by the end of the first week.
Robert McClemon of RinkWatch says 1,000 rinks were logged by the end of last winter, a quarter of those in the U.S. RinkWatch asks users to register their rinks by location, no personal information required. The only other thing they want to know is if it's skatable. RinkWatch is testing the theory that global warming is going to make it more difficult to have an outdoor rink. McClemon says the media tends to focus on threatened polar bears or Arctic ice disappearing.
Those examples don't really resonate with your average household here in North America who aren't going to encounter polar bears in their lifetime.
He says if the climate dampens our ability to skate outdoors, it might help make that connection. McClemon says they'll need a lot of data over many years to tell a larger story about climate change, and not just about weather variability year to year. And they've created a forum so users can share their ice conditions, rink-building expertise, and skating stories.
Older generations are saying, well, when we were young, we would build a rink and we could skate on it from, you know, the end of November right through till Easter, and you just can't do that today.
McClemon says it's begun a dialogue between generations about the quality of the outdoor environment. Back in Pittsburgh, as Mike Gordon watches his daughters and the neighborhood kids skate around his rink, he says he feels that tug of the past. His dad, a youth hockey league pioneer in Pittsburgh, started the ice rink tradition in his family.
I really do believe it was something he gave to us that was a gift that I want to pass on to my kids, and I hope that it kind of continues through the generations. I know that sounds a little sentimental or whatever, but it's true. It really is.
Climate forecasts predict wetter, warmer winters for Pennsylvania, but Gordon hopes there will be many more skatable days like this in the future. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Carol Holsoppel.
The Allegheny Front is produced in Pittsburgh and reports on Pennsylvania's environment. You can find out more at AlleghenyFront.org. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. Keep up with all the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. We're interested in your comments. You can send them to feedback@wvpublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at WV Public News and find us on Facebook. Support for our news bureaus comes from Shepherd University, West Virginia University, Marshall University, and Concord University. Our producer is Bennett Duccio. Our director is Teresa Wills. I'm Beth Voorhees.